You're now listening to The Brian Callen Show with your host, Brian Callen.
Yeah, man, it's a really beautiful book.
And, thank you.
Yeah, and which I would expect nothing less from a paleo artist, which is so funny. I guess that's what you call yourself?
Yeah, that's such a good term as any.
You're the first paleo artist I've ever met, sir.
Wow. Well, we're almost extinct, so I guess
John was just saying, I was asking him about his work doing all of the dinosaurs on Jurassic Park, and apparently, John, do you want to tell that story?
Oh, sure. There's more of a story than I've told you, and I can make it as long or short as you want.
Go ahead. We have an hour, for God's sake.
Okay. All right. So tell me when I'm on the air, okay?
You're on the air.
You're on the air.
Oh, great. Hi, everybody.
Hey.
Hi, Mom.
John Gerchi.
Yeah. Hi, everybody. Okay. Well, the story with Jurassic Park was, let's see, they first contacted me in the summer of 1990, and when I got their message on my answering machine, I didn't know who Amblin Entertainment was, but I called them back, and they said, you know, Steven Spielberg's movie company. And I said, oh, and they said, well, Steven wants to do a movie based on the book Jurassic Park, and he saw your cover, the cover that you painted for Bob Bakker's book, The Dinosaur Heresies, and he said, supposedly, he said, get that guy on board. And so they called me, and
that's a cool phone call to get,
yeah,
by the way.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was good.
I'm still waiting. I've been in Hollywood for almost 20 years. I'm still waiting for that phone call, you son of a bitch. Keep going.
Right. Well, okay, so I got the phone call, and I started the work. And at first I thought they were just after, like, anatomy and range of motion and maybe just a couple ideas about what they could do with dinosaurs in the 20th century. But then they told me they really wanted me to sort of go farther in developing the dinosaurs as characters, and also even come up with some storyboarding for plot elements and so forth. So I had always visualized the dinosaur called Velociraptor as these incredibly nasty, smelly chickens with switchblades. You know, and
chickens and, with switchblades. That's an awesome way of describing. Jesus, that's crazy. Go on.
Well, so they were doing a creature that was bigger than the biggest velociraptor that had ever been found. And the weird thing was that about 2 weeks after they made that creature, there was a find in Utah of a large animal that was of that same kind and hunted, but was very large, hunted with a big sickle toe claw.
Give us an idea of how big it is.
Oh, the Utah raptor, I guess, is about, it's something like person size. It's a little larger, I think, than the velociraptors in the movie, but it made it so that they weren't quite so nervous about extending that size range.
Mm-hmm.
So you're saying as big as a person?
Yeah, about as big as a person.
Okay. With a switchblade for a toe claw.
That's right. That's right. I mean that dinosaur is really a version of that dinosaur. It's actually called, its American cousin is called Deinonychus, and that kind of started the whole revolution about the thinking on dinosaurs, because a paleontologist named John Ostrom discovered these things and saw that sickle toe claw and got to thinking about how a sluggish, slow, and stupid dinosaur would hunt with a toe claw like that. And it just didn't fit. So he started thinking these things were a whole hell of a lot more active than we thought they were, and maybe even warm-blooded. So that kind of started the ball rolling, and then at some point Bob Bakker took up the ball and ran with it, and he published his heretical, supposedly, ideas in The Dinosaur Heresies in, I think, 86. And Jurassic Park was really the first time that those ideas were sort of incorporated into something mainstream. So they've kind of become the mainstream view, most of them.
Mm.
It's pretty awesome.
Yeah, yeah. One of the things you hear about the Tyrannosaurus Rex is that he was, in fact, a scavenger,
yeah.
Not a hunter,
right.
Which is outrageous to a lot of people who've grown up with the idea that—
Not to mention blasphemous.
Yeah, yeah, 100%.
Yeah.
Well, how much, as you've worked on these and if you reconstructed these animals— first of all, what is the one dinosaur that fills you with awe? What is the one dinosaur that you just think is like? I mean, how big was Brontosaurus? How big was Tyrannosaurus Rex? Give us an example.
They were big. I think everybody knows their size, and I've forgotten the tonnage. But I tend to go for the weird ones.
Mm.
The ones I like best are things like Stegomoloch, which is this, which has a beautiful name.
That was my nickname when I used to pit fight. They called me Sticky Moloch.
It's also something my Hungarian grandmother used to make for dessert.
Sounds good. Yeah. But it means monster from the river Styx, and that's what it looks like. It's a pachycephalosaur, but it's got, instead of a sort of rounded dome on its head like other pachys, it's got a sort of a helmeted, crested-looking thing, and then it's got all these spines and spikes and excrescences on the back of its frill. So it's a very weird-looking dinosaur, and you might think such a dinosaur would be a Dr. Seuss dinosaur, and in fact it is. It was discovered by and named by Hans Seuss, who's now at the Smithsonian. But anyway, it's a weird dinosaur, and it's I guess it's not one of the better known dinosaurs, but it's a very weird one.
And I'm looking at a picture of it right now. They look like they look like they could run fast.
I'm not sure if they could run fast or not. That would partly depend. I think that calculation would partly depend on how long their tarsal segment is.
I was going to say, you interrupted me. I was going to say, it depends on how long the tarsal segment is. I didn't have a chance to measure it.
Yeah, okay. John. Well, I'm sorry to take the words out of your mouth.
Right.
When you see a bird, they have these sort of backwards-looking knees. Well, those are, in fact, ankles. And the part of the leg below that is actually the tarsal segment. Mm. Those tend to be very long in animals that can run fast and also especially animals that hop. So rabbits, kangaroos, and frogs all have long tarsal segments. But anyway, I think that kind of judgment with Sticky Moloch would probably depend on such things. And I should make a disclaimer right now probably and say, folks, I'm not really a dinosaur expert. even though the credits listed me as a dinosaur specialist, right. I basically in doing paleo art where I reconstruct dinosaurs for various museums and publications and so forth, I generally talk to the experts and sort of get their take on it and try to make an intelligent decision if there's not a consensus, which there sometimes isn't. Mm.
Well, I think what all this brings up and what's so amazing as you go, as I went through Shaping Humanity is, you know.
And he loved it. By the way, just John, I mean, one of the things that Hunter called, he goes, dude, this book is awesome. I got about three phone calls as he was reading. This is awesome.
Great.
And for Hunter to say that, who's read every book there is,
yeah.
You know, that's a ringing
endorsement. Because, yeah, I mean, I was a biochemistry major, and, you know, I mean, so often there are, you know, the debates that go on about evolution and all that sort of stuff where, you know, people don't really understand the process by which scientists are coming to these conclusions, how they're trying to figure out, you know, how our human evolution happened. And, you know, one of the great things about this book is it really sort of shows you, oh, okay, here's the state of our knowledge. Here's the things that we know. Here's
right.
how we've reached the conclusions that we've reached.
Yeah.
But one of the things that it does that. It's also the artistic element of it is so fascinating because, you know, what you're hinting at with the dinosaur stuff and what becomes really, really clear in the book is we have this amazing record of, you know, bones. And then there's so much inference that has to happen with all of the soft tissue.
Right.
Yeah, so, I mean, you know, and one of the things that I found really, really fascinating in reading, you know, as we get into Shaping Humanity is, you know, apes have dark sclera. They don't have whites to their eyes.
Right.
Humans have whites to their eyes. So could you talk to us a little bit about that
sure.
and you know, where that thinking comes from and all that sort of stuff?
Sure. It's, first of all, I should give another disclaimer. In the last case, I said I wasn't an expert. With hominids, I am at least an expert on primate facial anatomy. So I've done lots of dissections of gorillas and orangutans and chimps and bonobos and even humans. And that's the background research by which you back this kind of work up. So there are some features, it turns out, that have a very strong correlation, some soft tissue features that have a strong correlation with bony tissues. So you can measure, for the example, you can take certain measurements of the eye socket and you can predict the eyeball diameter because that relationship is so similar in apes and humans that it's a pretty good guess for human ancestors, for things that are extinct, that where you only can measure the eye socket and you have to predict the rest. So some features are like that. And then some are more, they're harder to predict. And the timing of the the whites of the eyes evolving in humans is one of those latter, one of those where you really have to make a judgment call about when in human history that might have happened. So that means you have to look at what it's related to. Why do we have these depigmented whites of the eyes? The apes generally have very dark sclera, and we can most people would agree that the earliest humans probably also had very dark sclera. So why did we lose them? Well, it turns out that having whites of the eyes is tied to all sorts of social things. Direction of gaze is very important in primate social behavior, and in some cases it's important to hide the direction of gaze because, for example, if you have aggressive intentions toward one of your troop mates, the typical primate way of expressing that is a sort of a cold stare, and if you want to disguise that intention so that there's the element of surprise should you decide to attack that troop member, then it might be best to have that individual not be able to predict exactly where you're looking. There's all sorts of other social behaviors that tie into it. For example, there's a danger signal they've discovered fairly recently. There's a danger signal that develops in the brain when you see a large expansive sclera on another individual, and as in a look of terror. So that you can see why that makes sense to react to another's terror by thinking maybe I should be terrified myself. Mm-hmm. Sometimes that signal is generated on a subconscious level. Sometimes it's conscious, but anyway, it's another one of those social factors, so you have to sort of figure that out. The other thing is, if you are hiding in a forest, you don't want these white headlights kind of peeking out of the shadows. So so one answer to the problem might be to look at when humans started incorporating more open habitats, because it was no longer even effective to try to hide. And that happens fairly early on. It happens with, at least by Australopithecus afarensis, which is Lucy's species. At least by that time, humans were incorporating more open environments. So the Smithsonian team and I made a guess that by that time, those whites of the eyes were incorporated as part of the human picture.
You have a section devoted to Lucy. Explain to us the significance of Lucy. We all learned it, but explain it to us.
Yeah, sure. Well, Lucy was a big surprise when it was found in 1974 because it was such a complete skeleton. I mean, you hear estimates of 40% or so often in reference to Lucy. But they found, you know, most of a skeleton. Unusual finds of Australopithecines, like she is, would be like an isolated bone or tooth, but never anything like a whole skeleton.
Just a bone or a tooth, and we have to kind of, and it's like a detective story from there.
Yeah, that's right. So, wow. So some of the leading sites before that had maybe produced two partial skeletons, which means really partial. And then the rest, isolated bones and teeth.
And that is what we're basing so much of our evolution of man
Sort of. Okay. But, I mean, it's gotten better as time goes on. But before that point, we didn't have anything like a complete Australopithecus skeleton. Finding Lucy meant that you could make a sort of an outline of what the body proportions were like. For the first time, you could compare her upper arm bone with her upper leg bone. And that turns out to be an important ratio. And so a lot of argument has been based around that. So for the first time, we were sort of getting a body outline of what these things looked like.
Mm-hmm.
Since then, there have been a number of complete skeletal finds in the record. So that only makes it better as far for those of us who are trying to work out body blueprints for these ancient humans.
Skeletal outlines. And what did Lucy look like? She looked a lot like a chimp.
If you saw her walking down the street, you would probably say that she looked like an ape walking on two legs.
Yeah.
Her appearance would be very ape-like, but her movement would be very familiar and human-like. And if you were a primatologist or an anthropologist, you might go out into the street and lift her upper lip to take a look at her teeth. You would see, especially in males, if there was a male with her, let's say, you'd see that the canine tooth is small. And that's unusual for male primates because it's their primary weapon of battle and intimidation and so forth. So it's pretty unusual for that to reduce, for it to actually get smaller. And that's what you would have seen in the mouth of Lucy's male compatriots, and females have fairly.
But isn't it possible that Lucy was just another type of ape that went extinct?
Well, let's see. If you wanted to propose that, you might have trouble on several fronts. For one thing, Lucy shows all sorts of modifications up and down her skeleton for walking on two legs. Hmm. And those modifications are pretty much some of the same modifications that we modern humans have for walking bipedally. So that would be a pretty suspicious thing. But if you still wanted to somehow deny her ancestry or relatedness to later humans, you would still have to explain the small canine teeth, and you'd have to explain some of the details of the base of the skull, and a bunch of other stuff that coincidentally, in this model with her not being related, coincidentally resembles modern humans. And I think it's a much more parsimonious assumption to think that she is related to our ancestry.
Because there's the idea, what if this was just a deformed ape and didn't survive? And I mean, I'm sure those were all taken into account.
Yeah, it would have to be deformed in just the right way. It would be very suspicious as any sort of deformation for the knees to be angled like a modern human's, for the pelvis to be reshaped in a way that moves the muscles around and makes it possible to walk bipedally, and a bunch of other changes in the foot and in the ankle, in the spine, with a little bit of curve, backwards curve to the lower back. All that stuff, to propose that all that was somehow a deformed or mutant version of an ape, it sort of stretches credibility, really.
The book does such a good job, too, of describing. I mean, your work is just, it's so detailed. I mean, the understanding of how the musculature of the body and things.
Yeah.
I mean, you'd also have to be kind of an expert on that as well. I mean, you probably studied, you know, a chimp and apes' muscularity. I mean, you've probably gone through that as well. You're probably a bit of an expert on all that soft tissue.
Yeah, I definitely have to. You definitely have to know a lot of anatomy to do this kind of thing.
Why are they so? Why are they? How much stronger is a chimp than? Because I like to Google naked. I mean, hairless chimpanzee.
Yeah,
and
I know.
Certain chimpanzees have lost their hair, and oh my god, are they muscular?
Brian has a photo in particular on his iPhone, and he always
I'm obsessed with the power, and I actually rehabilitated orangutans in Indonesia. I went and did an earth wash thing, in college. So I was amazed at how strong they are. If you ever grab a baby chimp, which I have, they feel like a piece of stone with some fur on them.
I've even had my finger pulled on by a baby gibbon, you know, a small.
Oh, sure. I've had that done, too. Yeah.
And they are incredibly strong.
Yes,
I mean,
they are.
I couldn't believe how strong this baby was. I mean, I could get my finger back, but just barely.
Yeah.
You know?
Now, you're not doing that with a chimp. Chimp will pull your finger off.
Oh, I know.
Why are they so strong? What is it about their muscles?
Well, I think the real question is, why are we so weak?
Mm.
I think really everything's strong. In general, we really stand out among, if you compare us with apes or if you compare us with mammals in general, we really stand out as being kind of the weaklings of the mammals or primates.
So annoying.
And
it's so annoying to me. I don't.
Yeah, I know. I'm
I don't go to zoos because I feel diminutive.
Yeah.
Because I feel ashamed of my bone structure.
Yeah, I know. Well, you can't help it.
That's true.
You can't help it. But I think the reason for that is just that we have so many cultural solutions to problems that animals, apes in particular, make problems that they solve by brute strength of their bodies, basically, and we solve them with cultural means. So increasingly, I think that was true, or at least this is the consensus, that was true increasingly as you look in the archaeological record, that early hominids were maybe, you know, whereas we would invent a travois to drag a big piece of meat back home, or maybe even something with wheels on it, or something like a backpack, or, you know, a cultural solution, they would just sling the rhino haunch or whatever it was over their shoulder and take it home, you know.
Yeah.
So I think the answer, the real question is, why are we so weak? And I think we are because we depend less on physical solutions.
Mm.
That doesn't mean that Brian wouldn't like to look like a shaved chimp.
Yeah.
Well, you go. You do that.
You go, Brian. You go.
Yeah.
Yeah. While the rest of us humans we use our brains.
Yeah. 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 I'm going to go back to my cultural solutions.
Yeah.
Exactly. But we do now, as we found more of this, we've gotten better at reconstructing from skeletal remains.
Right.
How complete is this picture of human evolution for us?
You mean the picture that's represented in the book?
Yeah, and what early man looked like and where he came from.
Okay. So let me address first what they looked like. I think that's a little easier.
Mm-hmm.
We can say, for some features, we can say, yep, they were definitely there. For example, you look at what's called a robust Australopithecine. It's like Lucy, but with a big crest down the top across the top of their skull, like a mohawk.
Mm-hmm.
The males, at least, have that. And we know what that means, because male gorillas have it and male orangs have it. And they only creatures have it that have a big... that have large chewing muscles, basically. So we know that thing had a large chewing muscle. So we can look at certain modern analogs, and we can figure out what certain things mean. And we're pretty certain about those. But as I said before, there are some that are really hard to nail down, like whites of the eyes and so forth. So those are more of a guess. As far as the picture of evolution that is out there today, or the picture of human evolution, I think that the picture 100 years from now will probably be very different. And the reason I think that is because there are all sorts of signs that we're still in the early days of working out the details of this. And one really good sign of that is that each new find brings with us surprises, things that the previous model hadn't anticipated. And so we're still learning about this. And, for example, there have been two... headlines in the anthro world, in the paleo anthro world, in the last 6 months or so. One in October, and one more recently. And one of them was a new skull that was announced from the Republic of Georgia, a site called Dmanisi. The other one was some 400,000-year-old DNA, and what the implications were of those findings. And the funny thing is that one of those. One of the interpretations based on one of those finds makes the human family tree simpler, and the other one threatens to make it more complicated.
Hmm.
So it just shows you that we're still changing our model, the details of our model, with each new find. Now, is there any doubt that among these experts that humans evolved? Well, no. In fact, I can't imagine the mental gymnastics you would have to go through to know about the human fossil record and still be a denier of evolution. You know, you have
really that's very interesting to me, because
yeah.
I'm not a scientist, but I certainly believe in the scientific method and all that, and I don't have a whole lot of time for the other superstitions in the world. But but I do think there's a missing link to evolution. It feels that way.
Well, I think that's what's so great about the book is that, you know, so much of what the lay experience, like the average person's experience of seeing this stuff is that, you know, we see a shattered skeleton like Lucy, and, you know, the head isn't really there and all of that sort of stuff. And then we're supposed to believe that, you know, this very, very partial skeleton that we see somehow shows that we're descended from apes. It's not a very convincing thing, and so much of what, you know, Shaping Humanity, your book, does is really fill in those pieces. We start to realize, yeah, no, I mean, it does such a good job of that, because you really start to see, oh wait, there are other finds, there's this context, you know, this piece of, like, I mean, you reference this, but there's the hole in the base of the skull that from which you can really infer how the head was aligned.
That's right.
Could you talk a little bit about that?
Oh, sure. The skeleton gives a lot of clues about posture, and one of the clues is that the hole through which the spinal cord emerges from the skull, it's at the back of the skull. It's more at the rear and underside of the skull in, let's say, chimpanzees and gorillas, but in humans, it's tucked underneath the skull, the brain case. So it's obvious that humans are carrying their skulls on a much more vertical neck spine.
Mm-hmm.
And apes are the neck spine joins kind of from behind. So it's a really strong postural clue. In fact, there's one candidate for earliest hominin that is called Sahelanthropus from 6 million years ago in Chad. That was argued to be a hominin mostly because of the position of that hole at the base of the skull. There's been a lot of debate back and forth about exactly how to interpret that and so forth, but it's one of the strong indicators that something is a hominid when you find a hole that's been moved up to the sort of the central part of the brain case.
Mm.
Yeah. And the other thing that I was really, I mean, just stunning in terms of reading the book is that, you know, this book really catalogs your work in adding this new exhibit to the Smithsonian, right?
Yep.
Yeah, right. And that work that was first laid out in 1984.
Well, no, it was first. I started the work in 1984, mm-hmm. And then the plans for that Smithsonian Hall stalled out. It stalled out for an incredible number of years until finally it didn't get really going again until about 2007. So, mm-hmm. Which was very disappointing, of course. Mm-hmm. But in the long run, it was very fortuitous because I learned so much in those intervening years. I got to study a lot of the original fossils, and I did lots mm-hmm. of great ape dissection and so forth. So by the time it was time for me to do those reconstructions, I was ready. I had a lot of knowledge behind me by that point.
But so go back to the what you had said before. There is no doubt for people who study this that we evolved from apes, that human
yeah.
evolution,
yeah.
that we started in the trees and then somehow started walking on 2 feet and
right.
shed our hair and all that.
Yep.
I don't know why we do that, by the way. It doesn't seem to be very effective way of living in these elements, this terrible thing called nature. But
well, go to page 254.
Yep.
No, I'm kidding.
I have. Yes,
it is in there somewhere. But
yep.
If you're talking about loss of body hair in particular, that one is not a big mystery because we have a special adaptation for shedding heat in mm-hmm. tropical climates,
mm-hmm.
and that involves using an enhanced sweat gland cooling system. So we use evaporative cooling throughout the surface of our body, and that keeps our bodies cool. But, of course, that doesn't function when you have a full coat of body hair, so that had to go.
Right.
And we have some good evidence that that humans have this kind of thing in place, have such a cooling system in place by 1.5 million years ago, because we have a skeleton from that time. And it shows that people living then were adapting to climate as we do, including their body proportions. So in tropical environments, you tend to get body proportions that maximize surface area per volume. In cold climates, you get just the reverse. You get a minimization of the surface area per given amount of volume. So we find this skeleton in Kenya that's of a Homo erectus youth. And it has, lo and behold, proportions just like a person living in the tropics today. So we can tell that they're already adapting to climate with body shape, and mm-hmm. almost certainly that would include sweating, and that requires a loss of body hair. So we know about that one.
But yet we have a lot of animals in the tropics that have a lot of hair on their body.
That's right. Yeah, mm-hmm. and that's a little bit of a puzzle. But humans have the unusual. One of the unusual things that humans do is they're active. Their activity doesn't cease at the hottest part of the day. They're active right on through the hot part of the day,
right.
And they can use that. They're such efficient body coolers that they can use that to hunt with. It's called persistence hunting.
Chasing their prey.
Yeah, and yeah. one of the first films you see in an introductory anthropology course used to be a film of these sand hunters in Africa running down over a period of, I think, 4 days, running down a giraffe. And the giraffe, just in the end, it just collapses.
It's incredible.
It's heat exhaustion, and it's basically a test to see who will drop out first, and the humans win the day. So
I've heard humans are the best long-distance animal.
Yeah, they are. They are very adapted as long distance, both in terms of long distance walking and endurance running. So that's one of our key adaptations, and I think it explains pretty well why we have naked skins while other animals living in the tropics don't.
Mm.
Have you read the book Born to Run?
I've sort of looked at pieces of it because my daughter has it.
Yeah,
read it. He lives it.
But what I mean, you know, is that, you know, because the endurance hunt, I mean, you know, in terms of figuring out, because so much of what we're doing is we're looking at these skeletons, and then, you know, there seem to be reliable things we can infer about anatomy. But of course, so many of the things that we're fascinated about is culture. Like, how did these early hominids live? Does it seem plausible to think that, you know, before we had, you know, bows and arrows and all of those sorts of hunting tools, that we were doing things like the endurance hunt?
Oh, well, I mean, since people still do it today, and since people obviously have the body proportions for that kind of heat stress adaptation back then. I would expect that they probably were.
Yeah.
One of the things we don't know is early on when meat started to be consumed, and we have good evidence of that because we have butchery sites and the stone tools that were used to make cut marks at the butchery sites and so forth.
We can just tell by the bones, right? By the way the bones are cut and stuff?
Yeah, yeah. You find cut marks on the bones, especially where tendons are attached, and bones are often smashed to get at marrow and that kind of thing. So it's a pretty clear signal about meat eating. But the thing we don't know is how much they were doing scavenging and how much hunting. We just don't know.
Yeah.
We don't have any hunting weapons from that age, and we don't have any.
We've never found any, huh? We've never found any sort of. I guess we wouldn't.
We have, but they're all later. We found projectile points, and we've even got some wooden spears from about 400,000 years ago. But nothing, you know, the record of meat eating goes back 2.6 million. So nothing in those early times to indicate. We don't have any weapon-notched bones or anything like that, so we don't really know the degree to which they were hunting or scavenging or doing something that's kind of a mix of those two, which is to steal kills from another carnivore. Definitely, that's a possibility too, but we just don't know what those proportions are. Maybe some new interpretive tool will come along and help us decide that.
But again, who knows what the next discovery brings? I mean, the fact that they found wooden tools from 400,000 years ago is amazing.
Yeah, it is.
It's
stunning. Took special conditions for them to find that.
Yeah.
That must be pretty wild to touch those kind of... I mean, you're so involved in reconstructing these things and really looking at these bones. And it must be just such a... I was thinking about that as reading the book. Just kind of... It must be a very strange feeling to be...
It is strange and wonderful. It's really wonderful to have these remains spread out on a table before you, and you know that this person lived a huge number of generations back, and that it was not at all like you in many ways, but maybe like you in some ways, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And you wonder about things like whether it you know, ever wondered about what the stars were, or observed the motion of the dreamlike motion of a running giraffe, and you know. Stuff like that. You wondered how it interpreted various things, and you wonder if it had feelings similar to you. And that's, I think, one of the intense parts of this kind of work is that you connect with these ancestors. You make a connection
mm-hmm.
with them. There's a place in Africa, in Kenya, called Olorga Sili. It's a site, and it has a lot of hand axes. You can find them everywhere on the landscape. And those were made between 200,000 to back to a million years ago.
God, hand
or
axes.
Maybe, yeah. Hand axes are these kind of teardrop-shaped stone tools that were flaked on both sides.
Man.
And you find those all over. And when you pick one up, you just can't help feel a connection to the last hand that held it. You know?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I should mention that we have forensic... artists, the FBI uses them a lot when they'll find a skeleton, and they can reconstruct what the face looks like. And it's worth noting, just for the people listening, that you can get a very accurate representation of what somebody's face looks like based on their skeleton. Very accurate. Isn't that correct?
Well, I would stop short of saying very accurate.
Okay.
I think the successes in that field are played up more than the failures. You know, especially when it results in a positive ID, which it sometimes has of some remains. But there are some confounding factors. For one thing, if you don't know how much fat that body had in it, you're going to be confounded by that. Because we are all over the map as far as, you know, and everywhere from obese to emaciated. And if you don't have any indication, like maybe you find some pants that were bought at Tall and Big Men pant clothing store.
Yeah.
If you have some indication of the amount of fat, then you'll be able to avoid that pitfall. But that's one of several features that are confounding factors. So you don't always get an exact... often you can get the general shape of the face right, but some of the details of expression around the eyes and so forth, I mean, you wouldn't be able to tell, for example, Betty Davis eyes from Marty Feldman eyes.
Well,
I don't
go.
Know. Yeah, I mean, Marty Feldman's eyes are pretty beautiful.
Yeah, yeah.
You know,
yeah.
For,
We're all dating ourselves.
Yeah.
I know we are.
Just for the listeners out there, Marty Feldman is an economics professor at Harvard who sort of invented trickle-down economics, Reagan's...
Actually, Marty Feldman was not... That's not the Marty Feldman he's talking about.
Oh, I'm
no,
sorry.
No, you nerd. You education nerd. Marty Feldman, you 30-year-old, was the actor in Young Frankenstein, etc., the comedian. Yeah. Oh, yep. God, listen to this guy.
Well, listen...
Can we erase the last 10 minutes?
Yeah. Exactly. Listen. Leave it to the Harvard kid.
Oh, wait a minute. I think I'm thinking of Martin Feldstein.
Yeah, you probably are.
Yeah, that is who I'm thinking of.
We're talking about...
You know, Martin Feldstein also does
have
beautiful
eyes. John, you and I are the same generation probably. No worries.
Okay.
Right. Unbelievable. Your work is incredible. I just got to tell you that. It really is unbelievable, man. I mean, it's just crazy. I mean, you must look at these things and go, how the hell did I do that?
Well, you know, it looks like... There's a high level of detail there, and it looks like this couldn't have been done by a sane person. I actually am fairly sane, and I think it's the quest for absolute realism that really drives you on and makes it possible to punch in each of those hairs one by one and make each pore and so forth, because you think you can think of the reward at the end of being, you have a being in front of you on the table, something that looks like it's ready to blink. So,
but what makes you this way? What was your, when did you realize you wanted to do this? The detail.
Also,
how
do you carve out this career?
Yeah. Because Steven Spielberg calls you.
Yeah, yeah.
But what do you think it is? Were you always this way as a kid?
Let me just answer the second question first. How do you manage a career of this? I'm still trying to figure that out, so let me just pass that question. Far as what drove me into this, yes, I did love this kind of stuff as a kid, and I grew up where there were a lot of fossils. This was just in a suburb just outside of Kansas City, and there were fossils everywhere, and so I started finding fossils and trying to figure out what it meant. And I have a little sculpted series of heads that my parents saved from a long time ago that I made as a kid. That, you know, it's sort of they're little clay heads and they look like a kid did them, but they're sort of the ancestor of the work that I did for the Smithsonian. So I've just always been fascinated by that stuff, and especially in high school, I had kind of an epiphany. Like I was fascinated pretty much when I was a kid. I was fascinated with all prehistoric life, especially dinosaurs, and I hadn't really realized how much it applied to humans. Such an odd creature as humans, and in fact, I hadn't realized what an odd creature humans are until high school. And then I had this kind of epiphany where I realized, oh my God, we are really something that takes some animal characteristics to new levels, and that evolution applied to us as well. And I just became fascinated with how such a phenomenon as a phenomenon as weird as humanity, how it started. So part of doing the work that I do is wanting to look at these things face to face. And since we lack time machines, this is the closest I can get.
Your representation of Neanderthals, which have been in the news lately. Apparently, if you have certain Neanderthal genes, you're more likely to get certain cancers, etc. If you saw a Neanderthal walking down the street, they don't look that different from modern day humans. They have broader skulls, and you know.
I think I would notice. I think if you had your eyes open, you'd notice. I mean, maybe on a New York subway. I've heard the comment that.
Yeah.
If given a shave and a suit, a Neanderthal might go undetected on a New York subway. Well, I would say only in New York.
Yeah, only in New York. How much bigger and stronger were they than modern humans?
Bigger. I think they were about 10% bigger body weight wise, but they were short and very massively developed. The muscle markings on their bones are very well developed, and the thicknesses, the walls of their long bones, show that great forces were passed through those bones. That's sort of using an engineering model of how bones grow. That seems to be true, that when you load more forces through a bone, it develops a thicker wall. And Neanderthals have really thick-walled arm bones and leg bones, so we can guess they were quite a bit stronger than us.
I was amazed to see how you know, a human skeleton, I think, only weighs on average 23 pounds. And if you have a guy who's 300 pounds versus a guy who's 150 pounds, the difference in weight of that skeleton is only about 6-7 pounds more.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Do we have any idea how much a Neanderthal's skeleton weighs?
No. Well, you know, I'm sure somebody has done that calculation.
Yeah.
But
I'm sure Google has.
I don't know what it is, though.
One thing that I definitely did want to ask you about is Piltdown Man.
Yeah.
That whole chapter is so fascinating because, you know, I teach some students who go to a very religious school where they teach that there are four different ways of explaining where the universe came from, and one of them is evolutionism. And, you know, Piltdown Man is definitely a thing that the creationists like to drag up to try and discredit human evolution. But I think it's a real success for the scientific method precisely because it was disproved.
Yeah, that's right.
You know,
doing science doesn't mean you don't make mistakes or errors about things. But what it does do is it's a method of inquiry that involves testing. So it's a self-correcting sort of a thing. So if there are mistakes made and the things that have been stated before are testable, then you can either confirm something by testing it a zillion times and having it come out confirming, or if not, maybe the idea is no longer tenable after you test it. It's one of the reasons why, for example, evolution is almost universally believed by biologists and other scientists is because it's been tested so many times and it has come out on top.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah, and I mean, just to give a little context, so Piltdown Man was this find that was found, when was it found? In the early 1900s?
Yeah.
And basically, in this site in the south of England called Piltdown, they found this skull that they thought was the missing link. Oops, they found out they realized 50 years later, it's the head of a man
with the jaw of an
orangutan.
Yeah. That's right. It was a hoax perpetrated by somebody, we still don't know who. Who knew what he was doing? Because he put it in a context of an ancient Ice Age gravel, mm-hmm. and he had put stone tools in there, and he stained the bones to make them look ancient.
What an a-hole! Stop with it. What are you like trying to? I mean, God, it sounds like just a religious fanatic who was like, you know what, I'm going to show these people.
Yeah, right. I know. It really messed things up, I'm sure, more than the person meant to, and maybe that's why he never revealed himself. He was horrified that it caused such problems. But one of the things it did when we started finding real evidence for ancient ancestors, some of them weren't accepted because they didn't fit with Piltdown Man. So, for example, Piltdown Man seemed to confirm one of Darwin's ideas that turned out later we know that is not true, is not borne out by the fossil record, and that is that... that brains enlarged early on in human evolution. It fit with that idea beautifully. So in a way, it confirmed what a lot of scientists were sort of guessing was true anyway. And then, not too far in the future, in 1924, when the first Australopithecus fossil was found, it had the reverse of what Piltdown had, and it had a small brain still, but with human-like teeth. So. Nobody could make sense of putting that kind of a find couldn't be incorporated into the human family tree as long as Piltdown was part of it.
Well, and the British just love the idea that the first man might be an English man.
Yeah,
of course. Naturally. The cradle of civilization begins in London.
And its name was Sherlock Harris. It's so tantalizing to look at these faces that you've brought to life and to wonder how much we might have in common with them. And I just thought that quote that you had at the beginning, which may or may not be true, that when Pablo Picasso walked into the caves at Lascaux and saw those cave paintings, he said, "We have learned nothing in 12,000 years."
Yeah, that's supposedly what he said.
Yeah.
I love that.
Yeah.
I love that, man. That does, you know, we had Jared Diamond on the podcast, and he was talking about how you can have people from the highlands of Papua New Guinea who've been isolated for 46,000 years. There is no tradition of writing or, you know, math or the things that, Europeans and Asians have and Middle Easterners have enjoyed and developed over 5,000 years. And yet you can take one of those people who've been isolated for so long and they, in one generation, you just take a child, and if you educate them properly, they are every bit as smart and capable mentally in everything as somebody who comes from 5,000 years of that tradition. What does that say about evolution and the brain?
Well, I think what it says is that we're all a united group. Humans, for all their differences and the big deal that we make of those differences, are really one united thing. We're all part of this big human group, and there's a reduced variability in modern humans in comparison to some expectations, anyway. That makes us seem that we're all united. So that's the big message, I think. Mm. And the fact that I think for example, ancient brains of anatomically modern looking people, let's say that the Upper Paleolithic people that lived in Europe 30,000 years ago, those brains, there's no evidence for any difference in size or morphology from our own brains. And you have to think of, that's amazing when you think of the technologies in comparison, their technologies of bone and stone and maybe wood, and their, you know, their hunting technologies and their skin processing technologies and so forth. And then you compare those to particle accelerators or intelligent Mars rovers, things like that.
Yeah.
That's incredible that that's the same brain that produced the same basic human brain that produced those.
Yeah, that is.
So I think it's just another sign of how united we all are, and how also how our culture has this tendency to kind of ratchet up and become more elaborate. It's different from chimpanzees are thought to have culture by one definition anyway, and that is the definition of behavioral traditions. But their culture doesn't seem to have this ratcheting effect that human culture has, where it gets more
potential. Elaborate. You're talking about potential.
Yeah, potentially. I mean, you don't have all human populations ratcheting at the same.
No, I'm saying human beings really do separate themselves from something like chimps because we have potential to do things vastly.
Yeah.
I mean, just beyond our imagination.
Right.
Why? We still haven't. I think that's where evolution hasn't really. We haven't really described. There is a marked and massive difference between the human brain and the human experience and all other animals, including including apes, our closest relatives. And yet we still are not able to explain that insane difference, this need to go beyond, this frontier mentality, this idea that we are consciousness, we are much smaller than that thing out there. There's so much more to learn. The quest for knowledge, right?
Yep.
These are questions that I mean, hey, John, solve that question for us.
In between looking at pictures of shaved chimpanzees, Brian does ask the bigger philosophical questions.
I ask the bigger questions, my friend.
All right. Well, can I call you back on that?
Yes, you can. John Gertie, we really appreciate you joining us, man. This is such a great book. It's a hard cover. You're not getting it on Kindle.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a beautiful book, man, Shaping Humanity. And you have to get... It's the kind of book that you have to get in its hardback cover. It's a wonderful gift, actually.
Yeah.
And because the pictures are incredible and your work is incredible, man.
Thank you.
You're a real
thank
artist.
You. And it's one of those books that's just beautiful to own and have on your shelf. Like it's such, you know what I mean?
I just carry it around so people know I'm a deep thinker.
Absolutely.
But Brian, with an artistic side.
They can tell that because your skin is so tight over those massive lobes of yours.
Well, that's true. John, good luck reconstructing this face, my friend.
Yeah, okay.
Good
did
luck.
You mean 0% body fat.
Yeah.
You mean lobes on his head or
we leave that.
I got different lobes.
Okay,
no personal questions, bro.
I guess maybe we better not answer.
There it is. John Gertie, thanks so much for joining us, man.
Yeah, thank you.
We appreciate it.
Thank you so much, John.
Yep. Right, bye. Later.
Oh, and by the way, I got some promos. Where am I going to be? I know I'm going to be in if this airs when I think it is, I'm going to be in New York, February 21st, 2nd, and 3rd. I'll be in at the Gotham Comedy Club. I'll be in San Francisco at the Punchline.
Woo!
Yeah, March 27th, 28th, and I'm sorry, February 27th, 28th, March 1st. Come on now.
You've been listening to The Brian Callen Show with Brian Callen. Be sure to like him on Facebook. Just search for Brian Callen Comedy and follow him on Twitter. Just search for @BrianCallen. You can also find him online by visiting his website. Just go to briancallen.com. Until next time, bye-bye.